Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
In 2024, export values grew 1% over 2023.
Looking at ag exports, USDA economist James Kaufman.
Growth was most significant in horticultural products, especially tree nuts, but also vegetables and fruits. Tree nuts were up 11%, especially due to almonds. 2024 export values of grains and feeds grew 2% over 2023 to $39.3 billion, which was led by rice and corn. Rice was up 19%, and corn was up 6%. Red meat values also grew 5% to $20.4 billion, largely on higher prices. Ethanol value was up 13%, driven largely by increased volumes. Conversely, soybean export values fell 12% to $24.5 billion. Cotton was also down, ending the year 16% lower than 2023.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The commodity price that we have to deal with in order to make sure there's a safety net is one side. But if we can bring the cost down, that helps as well, right? Because the input costs are less.
Absolutely.
Peter Welch is a senator from Vermont, member of the Senate Ag Committee, questioning Farmers Union President Rob LaRue and Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval.
One of you was talking about potash. We had a meeting in Vermont, and that's what they talked about. One of our grain suppliers, who really works very closely with the farmers, they're going to get hammered if the price of that goes up, and we get most of it from Canada. So my view on tariffs is do no harm. That should be the starting policy. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. We're already seeing the effects.
Yeah. And we just shouldn't do that to our hardworking farmers. Also, my understanding is the last time we had tariffs, a lot of our Midwest farmers lost market share to Brazil. That hasn't come back. Do you see that as a possibility that could happen again?
Very much so.
Yes.
All right. Well, also, you all talked about how hard it is for young farmers to get involved. And that's certainly true in Vermont. The cost, everything is really, really difficult. We've introduced a bill on farm ownership, the Farm Ownership Improvement Act. And what it would do is allow for pre-approval and pre-qualification process that is in the Farm Ownership Improvement Act that benefits farmers who are starting. You get this pre-approval, it cuts the red tape. Does that make sense to you as an option?
We're definitely in support.
Well, I appreciate that. And another thing, the Weather Act. We are getting wild weather. I know you've had it in West Virginia and Georgia. We've certainly had it in Vermont. Big floods in July of 23, July of 24. Crops got wiped out. We have to have an insurance program. These are vegetable, by and large, where the hassles that these farmers had to go through, they had to account for, like, each type of vegetable, carrots, how many onions did you use, how many radishes did you lose. And they went by wholesale price when all these farmers sell it, farmers market at retail. Don't you think it's time to change that?
Definitely.
Yes.
Well, you guys are doing a great job, I got to say. And my hope is that Senator Marshall and I have worked together on a lot of things, including this. But we've got to take the rhetoric out here. Like, for instance, farm labor you mentioned, immigration, big issue, very controversial, very political. But you know what's very simple? If you don't have farm labor, in Vermont, you don't milk the cows, and you don't. So you're with us on trying to do something that gives stability for farm labor so that our farmers who absolutely have to have that labor are able to get the job done, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, thank you. You know, another thing, I'm going to say this, it's Black History Month, and I just want to celebrate it. And I know there's a lot of young black farmers who'd like to get back on the land. Many families, especially in the South, as you know, did lose the foothold that they had. So my hope is that will include folks who've lost their land through historical reasons. So I won't ask you to comment, but I know you know any young farmer is a farmer we want to get on the land. Would you both agree with that?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I got to say I appreciate hearing from you. You know, I do think the work you're doing has the potential for us to unify and do things that get farmers stronger and our rural community stronger. So thank you very much, and I look forward to working with you. I look forward to working with my colleagues. Thank you.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So the importance of the Panama Canal, we got to remember what feeds it.
Brian Burke is president of JSA.
One of the advantages, the very distinct advantages of the United States, is our ability to move grain from production, the production part of the Corn Belt. This runs northwestern plains all the way through the Ohio River Basin of production area in the heart of the Corn Belt of the United States. We can move grain in this country more efficiently over more miles than any other place in the world. We think about some of our largest competitors in Brazil. That's a very truck-heavy movement. Our systems of shuttle trains, barges, and trucks make us the most efficient transportation country in the world. One key piece to that is how the Gulf of Mexico, how New Orleans is able to reach the rest of the world, and the Panama Canal is the linchpin of that whole piece. So, yes, we can export off the PNW, off in Washington and Oregon and the Columbia River, but that's a bit more limited. That's mostly a rail-only component, so it has the rail cost to it, as opposed to some of the more efficient barge moves. And that's mostly a Northern Asia destination market. For us to be really competitive in South Asia, Southeast Asia, Mediterranean Basin, we need that Panama Canal. So that running efficiently with its 25, 30 vessels per day instead of 15 or 16 vessels per day is a real key efficiency piece for New Orleans that feeds into the entire river system basin of the United States.
From the Panama Canal to the Witten Building in Washington, D.C., where USDA leadership is, Cody Besant, CEO, Plains Cotton Growers.
Richard Cordath was very good to work with on behalf of producers' interest. During the President Trump's initial administrative term, certainly he kind of knows some of the ins and outs of USDA from his time spent there, and so it allowed some longevity and some historical perspective. But also the administration as a whole moving very, very quickly with proposing nominations, trying to get people set up and running. That way they can get programs fully on board and implemented. Because keep in mind, this current administration has not 8 years, but just 4 years. And so there's a lot on the agenda to really address going forward, and not a lot of time, even though 4 years seems like a lot of time. There's a lot of big issues they want to address. So obviously in the near term for us, trying to get a new and more vastly improved farm bill before the end of the current one that expires in September. I think you'll see Chairman Bozeman, ranking member, Chairwoman Klobuchar in the Senate. And you have Chairman G.P. Thompson and the new ranking member, Angie Craig, in the House move very expeditiously to try to get a new bill done in a timely manner that's enhanced. They obviously have to figure out what to do and address the expiring continuing resolution that'll run through mid-March. And the House as well is starting off on their path to address reconciliation, which is a budgetary initiative. You're looking at tax reform for trying to look at how to either extend the current provisions that were enacted to the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Certainly that'll be a big point of negotiations going forward. And then you're also seeing a more aggressive approach on trade, whether that's developing new unilateral or bicameral trade agreements or enforcing ones on a more regular basis that were enacted previously to make sure our foreign partners are meeting their buying powers and what they have committed to in some of these more previously negotiated and implemented agreements. So a lot of moving parts at this point in time, and not a lot of time to really waste.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What's driving the cycles? Why are we hitting these 40-year periods?
From the Cattle Facts Annual Outlook Seminar, Matt Makins.
On that drought map, our chart, I just put that kind of brownish box. Look at all the orange shades, the drought colors there on the chart. Something happened in 1998 to lead us into this situation, especially with water issues to the west and subsoil water issues across all of the plains. And we chat a lot about this El Nino La Nina thing. And that's just a small little bathtub portion of the Pacific. We haven't even included the Atlantic either. I can take a look at the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean, and these guys ask about the Atlantic for a reason. Just like El Nino or La Nina is a warm or cold phase thing, this is the chart for the Atlantic. See a nice cycle there between the colds and the warm colors? The Atlantic has a long natural cycle. So does the Pacific. These two big oceans like to behave in certain ways for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So I thought, well, I know if they're going to be warm or cold phase, and I can clearly see the historic cycle there, I want to blend the two. Since we're sandwiched between the two, there's got to be an impact on the states. If I combine the two, they're either both warm phase, they're both cold phase, or they're opposites. And why on earth does that matter? I'll prove it right now. Map on the top left. I went back to 1895. I said, give me all the precip data since that point. And I started to clump the oceans in these warm or cold patterns. And I said, give me the frequency of drought in these years. So for an example, in this case, see the kind of teal, I guess it shows up on the projector? That means very low frequency of drought. This period was a lot of water, especially over beef regions. Okay? But there are three other possibilities. One gets drier still. And here's the last. Based on these big oceans and how they're behaving, I can tell you without any modeling data, I can tell you which frequency of drought we will be in. Don't believe me? There's the drought monitor for North America. I ended it in November because once we add snow, the drought monitor is... I'm going to put that drought map on the left. And there are my four situations on the right. Does not at all match that one. That would imply we have a surplus of water across beef country. Doesn't match the bottom left. Doesn't really match the top right because Mexico should be seeing lots of water. Do you know what phase that is and when it started? I'll give you a guess. It starts with a 19 and ends in a 98. Since 1998, the big oceans have told us you will be in drought more frequently than not. Those big oceans are very slow to change. Those big oceans do work with El Nino or La Nina. They give us more La Nina events. How long before we can hope for those two maps on the left? How long before we talk more about El Nino frequency? More wet phases? If history repeats itself within the next 5 years, we're going to see the Atlantic change its idea and start spreading in more moisture. These three things do work together. We talk about El Nino or La Nina a lot because it's the biggest impact, but internally, these guys are constantly asking me, have you seen the hint of change in the Atlantic yet? Part of this change does tie into the sun. Part of this change does tie into just how the oceans work around. But since 1998, 5 of 6 of our La Nina events have been more than 1 year. That's why I think it's not just a La Nina this year. We do it again next year, but we're closing in on the end of this and getting into a wetter phase within the next 5 to 10 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Since a nutrition title was first added to the Farm Bill in 1973, the year after I was born, farmers, anti-hunger advocates, Democrats, and Republicans all have come together consistently to pass a farm bill that ensures the food grown by our farmers makes it onto the plates of Americans.
At a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing, New Mexico Senator Ben Ray Lujan with Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall and Farmers Union President Rob LaRue.
Unfortunately, there are proposals being considered now that would undermine decades of success and disrupt the broad bipartisan coalition that has historically been the key to passing a farm bill. Mr. Duvall, would proposals to cut nutrition programs through budget reconciliation, a move that would impact the baseline of the farm bill, impede the ability of Congress to pass a farm bill that meets our needs in farm country and supports American families?
Your question is, would it impede it? I would think that would be a difficult conversation, and I think that is the conversation y'all will be having. Of course, it's our job to represent all of Farm Bill. We do know the benefits, and we do support a nutrition program, but we also know that there's a way smaller percentage that goes to help and support our food system through farmers to make sure that it gets from one season to the other, and that has been way too long of getting some attention of broadening the baseline, where my comment started in the beginning.
Where I'll agree, Mr. Duvall, is that there needs to be support for our farmers and ranchers and food producers all across America.
Yes, sir.
There's also been a grand bargain, if you will, to work with colleagues in all sides of this to say we should support our farmers and ranchers and we should support nutrition programs.
Nutrition programs were designed to give people a hand up in difficult times in their life, and we support that.
Amen to that, sir. I appreciate that. Americans wake up with fresh produce on their tables and cold milk in the fridges due to the hard work and dedication of this country's farm workers as well. These workers are an integral part of our country's agricultural economy and work every day to feed families across America. The response to that sacrifice has been relentless attacks by this president and others in his administration due to some of their efforts, as we see going on right now. I've raised this with Ms. Brooke Rollins, who I believe will be the next Secretary of Agriculture for the United States of America as well. Now, Mr. Duvall, yes or no, did you know that the USDA estimates that roughly half of the workforce is undocumented?
Yes, sir. Our number is 40%.
Do you think our farmers, ranchers, and agricultural operations who depend on that labor will survive when roughly half of the workforce is unavailable?
First, I'd like to say our farmers want a system that they can work within the law.
Amen.
And have a consistent workforce that is reliable so they can deliver their crops on time, good quality. And your question.
What, Mr. Duvall, what happens if, I'll use your number, what happens if 40% of the workforce for farmers and ranchers disappears?
It would be devastating to agriculture. You would see farms go out of business, and we could see an interruption in our food system like we saw in COVID.
I appreciate that, sir. And this is an area, Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, we can work on. There's one of the strongest bipartisan bills that came out of the House recently was with farm workers, with agriculture, with finding a way to get that done. Unfortunately, we didn't get it through the Senate, but it's one of those strong tools that I believe that we could look at as well and make sure that we have a stronger system. And we can do it at the same time by investing in border security. We can have strong border security. We can fix a broken immigration system. We can do this in a bipartisan way. First attention should be to what's going to happen to farmers and ranchers when it comes to lowering costs.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
CoBank is short for Cooperative Bank. We're part of the Farm Credit System that was established by Congress in 1916.
Corey Geiger is the lead dairy economist at the Knowledge Exchange Division at CoBank. Talks about an April base change.
Change actually happens once every 5 years. Historically, the U.S. Department of Agriculture calculated dairy cattle genetic evaluations, and about a decade ago, a group called the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding, think the Dairy Breed Associations, Holstein's jerseys, dairy herd improvement programs that milk test, dairy processing records programs, and the National Association of Animal Breeders, which is all the AI studs, artificial insemination, we're not talking artificial intelligence, have come together to form Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding. This is the 11th time in the U.S. dairy industry that we're having a base change. A base change basically is so the currency doesn't get overinflated. The currency in dairy cattle can be measuring pounds of milk, pounds of protein, pounds of butterfat, productive life, and there's actually 46 traits that they have different rollbacks on. But the rollback that I'm really following is for butterfat and protein, Tony.
And dairy cow choline.
For 73 straight weeks, U.S. dairy farmers pulled back on culling. That means they sent fewer cows to slaughter compared to the same week the year prior. So from the final week of August 2023 to the second week of January 2025, 73 weeks, culling has pulled back. That's 506,000 dairy cows, fewer dairy cows sent to slaughter. Now, why? The big question is, why is that happening? Three things. First came gender-sorted semen. So dairy farmers, probably 85 to 90% of the dairy cows in the United States are bred artificial insemination, which is driving genetic improvement. And so we can make our heifer calves. Once that started happening in 2009, genomics became available. Genomics is the study of DNA and comparing it to population. In the dairy cow is the most studied domestic animal on planet Earth. We know more about the dairy cow than any other food animal. The only other species on Earth that we have more genetic information are the humans and lab mice because of some research in laboratories. But so we have 10 million genomic records. So we can pull a DNA sample on a baby calf, compare it to these 123 million records, and we instantly know what that calf will do with 70% accuracy as a cow. Now we can make heifer calves, we can find out which ones are the good ones. In the beef market, as you talked about, cattle numbers are the lowest since 1951. And dairy farmers are using native beef breeds, a lot of Angus, Charolais, Limousin, and others, on dairy cows. And in fact, last year, all the AI studs in the country sold just over 9 million units of beef semen. We know 7.9 million units of that went to dairy farmers. So this is, and in 2017, it was nominal. It was only 2 million. We've like 400% growth from 2017 to 2023. And so we're making a very consistent beef calf, beef on dairy calf, very consistent gains, very efficient at making gains compared to a purebred Holstein and especially a Jersey. And it's transforming the space. We're figuring by next year, 15% of all the feeder steers and feedlot animals are going to be from a beef sire and a dairy mama.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
CoBank is short for Cooperative Bank. We're part of the Farm Credit System that was established by Congress in 1916.
Corey Geiger is the lead dairy economist at the Knowledge Exchange Division at CoBank. Talks about an April base change.
Change actually happens once every 5 years. Historically, the U.S. Department of Agriculture calculated dairy cattle genetic evaluations, and about a decade ago, a group called the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding, think the Dairy Breed Associations, Holsteins, Jerseys, think dairy herd improvement programs, the milk test, dairy processing records programs, and the National Association of Animal Breeders, which is all the AI studs, artificial insemination, we're not talking artificial intelligence, have come together to form Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding. This is the 11th time in the U.S. dairy industry that we're having a base change. A base change basically is so the currency doesn't get overinflated. The currency in dairy cattle can be measuring pounds of milk, pounds of protein, pounds of butterfat, productive life, and there's actually 46 traits that they have different rollbacks on. But the rollback that I'm really following is for butterfat and protein, Tony.
And dairy cow choline.
For 73 straight weeks, U.S. dairy farmers pulled back on culling. That means they sent fewer cows to slaughter compared to the same week of the year prior. So from the final week of August 2023 to the second week of January 2025, 73 weeks, culling has pulled back. That's 506,000 dairy cows, fewer dairy cows sent to slaughter. Now, why? The big question is, why is that happening? Three things. First came gender-sorted semen. So dairy farmers, probably 85 to 90% of the dairy cows in the United States are bred artificial insemination, which is driving genetic improvement. And so we can make our heifer calves. Once that started happening in 2009, genomics became available. Genomics is the study of DNA and comparing it to population. In the dairy cow is the most studied domestic animal on planet Earth. We know more about the dairy cow than any other food animal. The only other species on Earth that we have more genetic information are the humans and lab mice because of some research in laboratories. But so we have 10 million genomic records. So we can pull a DNA sample on a baby calf, compare it to these 123 million records, and we instantly know what that calf will do with 70% accuracy as a cow. Now we can make heifer calves. We can find out which ones are the good ones. In the beef market, as you talked about, cattle numbers are the lowest since 1951. And dairy farmers are using native beef breeds, a lot of Angus, Charolais, Limousin, and others, on dairy cows. And in fact, last year, all the AI studs in the country sold just over 9 million units of beef semen. We know 7.9 million units of that went to dairy farmers. So this is, and in 2017, it was nominal. It was only 2 million. We've like 400% growth from 2017 to 2023. And so we're making a very consistent beef calf, beef on dairy calf, very consistent gains, very efficient at making gains compared to a purebred Holstein and especially a Jersey. And it's transforming the space. We're figuring by next year, 15% of all the feeder steers and feedlot animals are going to be from a beef sire and a dairy mama.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What is going on with those northern high plains, Montana, the Dakotas?
At the Cattle Facts Annual Outlook Seminar, Matt Makins.
Downright cold right now, downright cold through mid-March. You're going to have a rapid warm-up as we hit late March into April. Precip-wise, same idea. On the left is a history recreation, and on the right is going to be your computer models. Not a very good match if you're looking for the corn country. Not a very good match if you're in California. Otherwise decent. As we recreate everything, that does not look very good for the Southwest, the Northern High Plains. As the Northern High Plains is getting some snowfall, it's not abundant snowfall. Precip-wise, there's going to be a swath from Dallas, close to here, but just north, from Dallas up to about St. Louis. For the Pacific Northwest, not a bad outlook. Canadian prairies are starting to dry off. This is May through July, okay? So I got you into the start of the growing season. Let's go to the first half of corn, okay? On the left versus right, history versus modeling. Not the best match, but not terrible. Why does modeling have a huge bullseye of heat over the central U.S.? This may come as a huge, tremendous shock. Models are very warm biased. They like to make things hotter than they actually end up being. We have to account for that. Reprocess that data. Know where the biases are. There's your outlook. We're going to have heat for the Southwest, the West, expanding into the Northwest, across Canada as well. Heat for the Southeastern U.S. Cooler pockets for Central and Eastern corn country. Computer modeling does not have any cool air over the central or eastern U.S. because it is biased. And also for another factor, and that's the monsoon. The monsoon last year I said would be dismal. It barely impacted anybody. This year the monsoon is going to be stronger. The monsoon is that moisture that moves in from Mexico into Arizona, southern California, southern Nevada, southern Utah, into New Mexico, parts of Colorado. May hit the panhandle of Nebraska. The greens on the map on the left, notice that difference versus the modeling. Modeling today does not see the monsoon happening. But I guarantee, well, I shouldn't guarantee you, but I'll give you a 95% guarantee that the models coming out the next 2 months will start to put the monsoon in there. So here's the forecast for the odds favoring your moisture outlook for May through July. That's beneficial for the pasture in the prairies down across the south and southwest, which have not had a lot of moisture. Where is that probably going to be wrong? The position of that grain right over New Mexico may shift into Southern California or drift a little bit into West Texas. That's going to be a big question mark for me. But look where the brown colors, the drought has moved. Across the Pacific Northwest, Northern Plains, Canadian prairies. Mexico, by and large, has had a tremendously bad drought. The monsoon can help that this year. It will be a stronger monsoon. What about the summer? So we've got through the first half of corn. I think the first half of corn does pretty well, especially to start. But somebody, whether it be Iowa, Northern Illinois, Southern Wisconsin, somebody in that region is going to be downright dry from mid-June through mid-July. Bad timing. There's going to be a pocket there, and you're going to hear the term flash drought. It's going to be somewhere in the central to western corn region. To finish the corn, look at the huge difference here between history and modeling. Modeling is very warm biased, especially this far out, by several degrees. That's why we reprocess everything. We don't accept it at face value because it has a bias to it. Try to strip the biases out. We've now cooled off central and eastern areas of the country. Very warm with drought growth across the northern high plains, the Pacific Northwest. Worry about wildfires. Same in Canada and the Canadian prairies. Moisture-wise, we're still spreading in moisture for the south and the southwest. If you ask me today to replicate what happened this last year from, say, August, September, October, November, I think we do that again next year. So there's going to be folks in Oklahoma that are worried about dusting in their wheat. They got to hope for that one system to get that wheat going. So there's your odds favor. Overall, not a bad look going into fall. It's going to be a drier winter, though, because we'll likely have La Nina again.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
USDA February Agricultural Trade Update. A completion of December trade data for the prior year. A completion of the 2024 trade year. As Agriculture Department economist James Kaufman notes from the Friday estimates,
the 2024 calendar year, ag exports $176 billion, which is 1% over 2023. Ag imports for the full year were $213 billion, which is 9% above 2023.
The result, a continuing growth. growing ag trade imbalance.
Imports exceeded exports by $21 billion in 2023. That gap has grown to $37 billion in 2024.
Looking at month-over-month ag trade data,
December ag exports were at $16.2 billion, which is 4% above the previous December. And December ag imports were $18.3 billion, or 17% over last December.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.